Henry James once said, summer afternoon. To me, those have always been the two most beautiful words in the English language. And many of us feel the same. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we celebrate the waning days of summer with our English language expert, Patricia O'Connor, author of Woe Is I and proprietor of the blog GrammarPhobia.com. We'll talk about summer words and phrases like dog days, bikini, lemonade, and barbecue. We also want to hear about your favorite summer words. And of course, Pat will answer your questions about the English language. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. In spite of the overflowing back-to-school sections of every store you visit these days, we still have a few weeks left of summer. And today we're going to soak up some sun with our English language expert, Patricia O'Connor. She is author of Woe Is I and a number of other books about the English language and proprietor of the blog GrammarPhobia.com. Hello, Pat.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. Welcome back.
Thanks.
It's a dreary summer day in Iowa today. Pretty cloudy.
Oh, too bad.
And a little bit misty, so we'll have to brighten things up.
Well, where I am, it is glorious. It's just one of those picture-perfect, not a cloud in the sky, light breeze, moderate temperature, flowers bursting everywhere. It just couldn't be better.
Oh, wonderful. That sounds like heaven.
Yeah, and on a day like that, you really think, can there be anything better than summer?
Right, right.
But like most of our words for the seasons, the word summer comes to us from old Germanic sources. Our words summer, fall, winter, and spring are all from Germanic. Only one of them, autumn, comes from Latin.
Interesting.
And it's a very old word, as you might expect. It's been around, well, it's been recorded in English since the year 825. And it's usually defined as the time from the summer solstice, which is 21st of June, to the autumnal equinox, which is 22 or 23 September. But, of course, to us, summer means much more than the dates on a calendar. But perhaps the word that chiefly comes to people's minds when they think of summer is the word vacation, which is extremely old. It was recorded in Chaucer. The line from Chaucer is, when he had leisure and vacation from otherworldly occupation. Now, at that time, vacation just meant release or freedom or rest from something. The modern word, the sense of the holiday, is from a 19th century American usage, but ultimately it comes to us from the Latin verb vacare, meaning to vacate. But the Latins, the Romans, weren't so hot on summer, because to the ancients, summer was not all wine and roses. This brings us to the phrase dog days. Now, the term dog days comes from Latin and Greek, and it is a term for the hottest part of the summer, and it was associated in ancient times with the rising of the dog star in the Mediterranean area. And because summer was supposed to be the most unhealthy period of the year and a time of ill omen, the dog star took on this pejorative connotation, and dog days also took on a pejorative connotation, meaning something hot, humid, sticky, unhealthy, perhaps.
You know, it's so funny because I've grown up I've spent my whole life with a lot of dogs.
Yes.
And so, of course, as a child, I just assumed that the dog days of summer were the days of summer where the dogs just laid and they had their tongues
panting,
lolling out.
I know, that's what I always thought, too. I thought, oh, that's the time when the dogs are lying around with, you know, panting.
Exactly.
And that's when you douse them with the hose and maybe give them a short haircut.
So it has more to do with the heavens
then. It's actually a celestial
term. Right.
Yeah. But nowadays, summer is a lot more pleasant because we have air conditioning and air conditioners. Now, this is a term, well, both of them, air conditioning and air conditioner, have been around for longer than you think. They were first recorded in, believe it or not, 1909. But back then, air conditioning didn't mean what it does now. It originally meant to artificially moistening and cleaning the air in cotton mills. And air conditioning then consisted mainly of a system of humidifiers and blowers. They didn't actually make the air cold. Now, the kind of air conditioning we know today, which actually produces cold air, didn't become a household word until the 1930s. So since then, summer has become pretty pleasant.
Well, it was a household word in the 1930s. That seems a little early to me.
Oh, well, yeah, I shouldn't say it became a household word. It became a known word for the production of cold air. But I don't know if you're too young to remember this, but when I was a kid, not everybody had air conditioning, certainly not central air conditioning. And theaters would advertise that it was cool inside, and they would have pictures of a little penguin or a little snowman, cool inside, and people would go to the movies in the summer just to cool off. But, of course, that's before your time.
Well, I still live without central air, and I still do that, actually.
Yeah.
But they don't advertise it to me. I just know where to go.
Yeah, right. But, of course, the ideal way to beat the heat is to take a refreshing dip in the pool. Now, this is an old Germanic word for a small body of still water, and it's been in English since the 800s, but its use as short for a swimming pool is much more recent. It was first recorded in 1906, and the longer term swimming pool, an artificial pool for swimming, was recorded in 1899.
Well, that seems very recent, actually.
Yes, swimming pool.
Interesting.
1899, yes.
It had to change from swimming hole to swimming pool, right?
Yes, yes. Probably swimming hole is older. I haven't checked that one out. But since swimming holes were older than swimming pools,
right,
it's likely. But people lucky enough to live near the ocean or a big lake can instead go to the beach. Now, this beach is a kind of a mystery word. We don't know where it comes from. It was first recorded in England in the early 1500s, and at that time in Sussex and Kent and adjacent counties of England, the word referred to pebbles worn by waves, worn smooth by waves. Afterward, it came to mean the seashore. But originally, when someone said he was standing on the beach, it meant standing on the worn pebbles at the edge of the shore. Later, it came to mean seashore, which is the meaning it has today.
Interesting. So they would have said seashore before then.
Right, right.
To be more specific, I guess.
Or they would have said the shingle. They would have said the shingle, which was another word. It meant sort of, and it referred to the surface of the beach, sort of a slaty, worn-away area, rather than sandy.
Right, which doesn't sound much like American beaches, at least
no.
Most American beaches.
Right, right. Now, of course, when you go to the beach or to the pool, you have to be properly dressed. And that's why we have terms like bathing suit, which dates from 1873, bathing trunks from 1895, and the much more recent bikini, which was first used in French in 1947 and later in English in 1948. And since then, We've had words for how we dress for the beach.
It's interesting because obviously it's going from more clothing to less clothing.
Yes.
Because the bathing suit, even men
yes.
wore full suits.
Especially
right?
Ladies. In the Victorian times, a lady's bathing suit was basically a dress, a kind of a shortish dress, at least only to the knees, with probably bloomers or tights or something like that underneath to cover the bare legs. So there really wasn't much skin showing in a bathing suit of 1873.
I read a children's book with my daughter about some of these early swimming feats. It was about a woman mm-hmm. swimmer who I can't remember where she swam, but she had done all of these amazing long swims. And of mm-hmm. course, wearing those woolen suits seems
oh,
like
yeah.
such a drowning
oh, I know.
issue.
I know. I just wonder how many people were drowned by the heavy clothing they had to wear.
I can't imagine.
Yeah, but a much more recent term is sandals. Well, this was first recorded in 1382 in a biblical translation, which isn't surprising since it was the footwear of the Greeks and the Romans. Now, despite whatever you wear on a beach, you're likely to get sunburned. Now, this is an old formation. It started out as it was a noun, sunburning, and a corresponding adjective, sunburnt, which both came along in the 1500s. And then
I was going to say they have to be very old words. It seems like should go back before then.
Oh, sure. Sure. And sun itself was recorded, you know, as early as recorded English writing. It dates back to the 800s. And so it's you know, it's not... actually, I sometimes wonder why the 16th century English had a use for the word sunburn, since, you know, according to lore, it doesn't really get all that hot and sunny in England. But I guess they have their hot days, too.
Right, right. Well, and they're a pale people, so.
Yeah, yeah. But let's go on to consumables. Now, when you're lounging on the beach or at the poolside, a cool drink is nice. For instance, lemonade. Now, this word for a drink made from lemon juice, water, and sugar was first recorded in the 1600s, and orangeade for a carbonated orange drink came along in the 1700s. And yes, they did have carbonation in those days. Now, back then, carbonation meant made effervescent by dissolved carbon dioxide added to a liquid. And people have actually been making carbonated water since the 1700s and carbonated orangeade since about the same time. So that was kind of a surprise to me when I researched that. I didn't picture, you know, fizzy drinks back then. But
they probably didn't serve it over ice.
No. No. But both lemonade and orangeade were borrowed from French. And the popularity of lemonade and orangeade led to the use of the suffix A-D-E to form nouns for other kinds of fruit drinks, limeade, cherryade, gingerade, many that we haven't really heard of lately.
Right. Well, and of course, again, in my childlike mind, I assumed because lemonade sort of rescued you on a hot summer day.
That it was spelled A-I-D?
Well, I figured it had morphed somehow, but somehow that was what it was for. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with our English language expert, Patricia O'Connor. She is the author of Woe Is I and a number of other books on the English language and proprietor of GrammarPhobia.com. And you can join our conversation with your favorite summer words as well at 866-780-9100.
The days are longer, the shorter, the sun is shining.
It's noticeably warmer.
It's summer, every single moment is worth its weight in gold. Summer, like the world's best story, and it's waiting to be told. It's ice cream cones and cherry soda. It's summer, man, where do we begin? Summer is ponds and pools and garden hoses trying to beat the heat. Summer, bicycles and roller skates and even just bare feet. It's also surfing tidal waves, creating nanobots or locating Frankenstein's brain. Finding a dodo bird.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is English language expert Patricia O'Connor. She is the author of Woe Is I and a number of other books about the English language, and also the proprietress of GrammarPhobia.com, the blog there where you can ask your English language questions. And of course, you can ask them here as well at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Right now, we're focusing on summer words and their history. But of course, you can share your favorite summer words, ask your questions, or we can also talk about other English language questions as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. All right. And Pat, we left off with lemonade. Let's move on to harder stuff.
Okay. Good. in case lemonade just won't do it for you, you can always turn to a tall, cool one, a beer. which the OED defines as an alcoholic liquor obtained by the fermentation of malt or other saccharine substance flavored with hops or other aromatic bitters. We don't often think of all that when we're downing a beer, but etymologically, it's from Old Germanic sources again, and it's been part of English since around the year 1000. It may come from an old Germanic word meaning barley. That's a little uncertain. But one thing that's certain is that when you do a good time to kick back with a beer and put your feet up is right after you've packed the kids off to camp. Now, camp is a word that comes from Latin. We'll give Latin its share here. The Latin word is campus, a level field. And in Roman times, it meant specifically the Campus Martius at Rome, which means war field, which is where games, athletic practice, military drills, and such were held. And this is actually what gave us the terms field of combat and field of battle. Those were originally terms for the Campus Martius in Rome. Now, in English, the noun camp has been used in the military sense since about the 1500s, meaning a place where a military installation would be located. And the use of the word to mean a place to go camping is derived from this. The phrase campground dates from 1806 and campfire from 1837. And while war doesn't necessarily go on at modern camps, it's full of its perils, as we know. And one peril of camp life is poison ivy, a summertime peril. And I practically always have poison ivy myself since we have two golden retrievers and they're always bringing it back on their coats. Now, people often don't realize that this can happen. The dog goes into a patch of poison ivy, doesn't hurt the dog, but he brings back the oils.
Yes, and the more times you get it, the more likely you are to get it. So.
Yes, and I seem to get it in the same spot all the time. Well, a couple of spots on my forearms. And for years, I never got it. Now, all of a sudden, I started getting it just this year, and I seem to always have it. I get it again and again. But the scientific name for poison ivy, the plant, and it was first recorded in the U.S. in 1788, is Toxicodendron radicans. And it's not a true ivy, by the way, but the sap that causes all the blistering and itching is a compound called urushiol, which is contained in the plant leaves and stems. And as a kid, you might have been warned against it with ditties like Leaves of Three, Let It Be,
mm-hmm.
or Hairy Vine, No Friend of Mine. No, you may have had your own. Maybe some listeners had their own little warning rhymes that they were given as kids. But another summertime pest is the dandelion, and it's a peril in the eyes of people who care about their lawns. We don't bother taking ours out. But this word is an adaptation of a French phrase, dent de lion, which means teeth of the lion or lion's tooth. In medieval Latin, it was named dens leonis, lion's tooth, from the toothed outline of the leaves. It has jagged edges. And dandelion was first recorded in English in the early 1500s. And in the U.S., fresh dandelion greens are sometimes used as food or an herb. And this has been true since the 19th century. And you can still sometimes find dandelion greens being sold at the farmer's market, or you can pick them yourself, and they're good in a salad. But this brings us back to consumables, of course. And a very nice summer word, I always think, is barbecue. It's a fun word. It's sort of fun to say, and it's a fun event. And it was borrowed in the 17th century from a Spanish word, barbacoa, which is a word the Spaniards picked up in Haiti. And it was a word in the Arawak language. That's A-R-A-W-A-K. That was a language of indigenous peoples in the Caribbean. And in the Arawak language, a barbacoa was a treehouse or a wooden framework set on posts. It wasn't a cooking apparatus, But the Spanish adapted that word for a wooden framework for cooking. And it referred to the drying, mainly to the drying or curing of meat or fish on this framework. And
so not the kind of event where the kids stand around saying,
is
the dried
yet?
Fish dry yet?
yeah. The first use of the word in English for the actual cooking of meat or fish over a grid-like framework came along in 1690. So that's been around for actually quite a while, barbecue. It's been spelled all different kinds of ways.
Interesting.
Yes. Often it's just spelled BBQ. But there's another word that we also got from a foreign language for our summertime meals, the word picnic. Now, it comes from the French word pique-nique, spelled with Q's, which probably came from the verb piquer, to pick or peck. Now, in French, a pique-nique wasn't what it is today. It was more like a potluck. And originally, when we borrowed it from the French in the mid-1700s, it meant a fashionable social event at which each guest contributed a share of the food. It was more like a potluck.
Okay.
So, and now it means an informal meal eaten out of doors, especially as part of an excursion to some place like a countryside or a park, whatnot. So that's how we got picnic. It's also a very old word.
Interesting.
But a more recent word, which is all American, we don't owe it to any other culture, is hot dog.
And no other culture would seek to claim it, I don't think.
No, I don't think they would. Now, by the way, don't try to get a good hot dog in a foreign country. If you see a hot dog stand, I'd pass it right by. I once bought a hot dog when I was on vacation in London, just because I was sort of nostalgic for American food and, a hot dog stand. So I came to the stand, and it had the wieners boiling furiously in a tub of water, and they probably had been boiling that way for hours and hours and hours. So by the time one was fished out and put on my soggy roll, it was just mush.
Ugh.
And it was, let me say that I actually made my way to a wastebasket to get rid of the one bite that I took, which is something I normally would not do in a public place, but it was just god-awful. So anyway, that's my tip of the day.
All right, advice to live by.
Yes, but back to hot dog. It was first recorded in the late 19th century, and there are earlier and earlier sightings coming up all the time. I think the earliest are still from the 1880s. But back then it consisted, as of now, of a long sausage-like piece of meat served on a long, soft roll. And it's suspected that it got its name because it was popularly believed to have included dog meat. And this was kind of as a joke. I don't think it ever did really include dog meat. But the term red hot in the 1890s also referred to a hot dog or to a frankfurter. And in case you're wondering, frankfurter and wiener are both, those are also used in America, but they are named for foreign cities. Frankfurter is short for Frankfurt sausage from Germany, and wiener is short for Vienna sausage, which is from Austria. But I always remember the spelling of wiener, that the I comes before the E, because of Vienna sausage. It's short for, you know, it means Vienna, and in Vienna, the I comes before the E.
And they don't claim the hot dog.
They don't claim the hot dog. They know better than to do something so impertinent.
Right.
But, which, you know, the hot dog leads us naturally to ketchup, which is not an American term, but it comes from around 1700 when it meant a sauce made from the juice of mushrooms, walnuts, tomatoes, etc., all ground up and used as a condiment for meat or fish. But the word apparently came from Chinese, and in the Amoy dialect of Chinese, a word spelled ketchup or ketchup meant a brine of pickled fish or shellfish. And in early usage, the OED quotes an English trader writing in 1711 in his journal, soy, meaning liquid soy sauce, soy comes in tubs from Japan, and the best ketchup from Tonkin. And he spelled it K-E-T-C-H-U-P.
Huh.
So it does seem to be from this Chinese term.
And how about the iterations, catsup, that
Those
kind of thing?
Those are all just variations. It really was originally spelled K-E-T-C-H-U-P.
Huh.
And a lot of people assumed that it must be wrong and it was cats something.
Huh.
No, those are just variations. It wasn't really catsup. Ketchup is the word. But no summer picnic would be complete without, you know, hot dogs, ketchup, but also without Jell-O. Now, this is a trademark term that comes from 1934, and the date makes sense because people couldn't make Jell-O until refrigeration was more or less commonly available. The OED defines it as the proprietary name of a powder used to make a fruit-flavored gelatin dessert. And it's interesting. I was reading about the history of Jell-O a few years back, and it has an interesting sociological significance because Jell-O became sort of a status item back in the 30s because if you brought Jell-O to a picnic or to a potluck or something, it meant that you had refrigeration. You had an icebox.
So it was a status symbol somehow?
It was a status symbol. Back in the early days out in the country on the prairie, it meant that the housewife had refrigeration, and not everyone did. Sometimes people just had an ice house with a block of ice, but which probably wasn't enough to firm up the Jell-O.
Right, but it was enough to make the next treat you want to talk about.
Ice cream. Now, would you believe that this dates back to 1672?
I believe it because I can't imagine living without it.
Oh, yes. It was first recorded then, back in England, when it meant a semi-soft frozen dessert traditionally made with sweetened and flavored milk fat. And, of course, the more fat, the better it tastes. Now, the ingredients have changed over the years, but the meaning is basically the same. The cone, however, didn't come along until later. The term ice cream cone dates from 1905 in English, but the Parisians apparently were the first to get the idea of wrapping up a waffle or a thin wafer-shaped thing into a cone shape and putting ice cream inside it, the better to drip all over your front. But the term ice cream cone is from 1905. But dripping frozen treats probably put you in mind of what?
Popsicles.
Popsicle, of course. Now, this dates from 1923 when it was first recorded in an advertisement in a newspaper, and it was called a drink on a stick. The OED defined it as an ice lolly, but of course, lolly is the British term for it. The derivation is uncertain, but it's probably a combination of lollipop and icicle. And there was actually an earlier product, ice pop, more than 30 years earlier, and this was a term first recorded in Kansas in 1896. And when we think of making a mess of ourselves, we also think of eating watermelon.
Right. That's always a wonderful thing. I want to talk about popsicle a little bit more for a second,
uh-huh.
And that has a wonderful word associated with it on so many packages,
uh-huh.
And that's quiescently frozen.
Now, I've never noticed that.
You'll have to look. You'll have to look at packages.
Quiescently
and
frozen?
I've looked this up because quiescently means to freeze in a restful state. Because
Well, it sounds like the popsicle was struggling furiously. Don't freeze me.
But they made the distinction, apparently, because ice cream and a lot of other frozen treats were made by...
Oh, yeah, by cranking.
Exactly. And so it just means that you just put it in a cup and freeze it.
Well, I wonder why
it sounds very fancy,
considered,
though.
Considered, you know, more elegant than cranking it in a crank. I don't know. But you could hardly put it on a stick if it were being turned in a crank.
Right.
Oh well. But I wonder if the popsicle was, or the ice pop from the 1890s. I wonder if those were the first foods to be served on a stick. I didn't research that one.
Yeah, that's a great question. We'll have to research that for state fair coverage coming up soon.
Yeah, you could do a whole show on Iowa State Fair terminology. You should get an entomologist to do that for you. There's the corn dog on a stick and the, what is it, the butter on a stick, butter?
Oh, yeah, it was actually deep fat fried butter. I don't think they could put that on a stick.
No.
I don't know.
Oh,
I didn't eat it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But you wanted to talk about...
If you had eaten one last year, you'd still be dieting to get it off now.
Exactly. You wanted to talk about watermelon.
Right. Well, this is kind of an obvious word. It gets its name from its abundance of watery juice. And it actually was named that by the French. They called it melon d'eau, which literally watermelon, melon of water. The word watermelon goes back to the early 1600s. But in conclusion, and then maybe some callers might want to call in. In conclusion, summer wouldn't be summer without baseball, which is an American term first used for the game in 1845. But this familiar American game wasn't always called that. It was known as under a number of other different names in earlier years. It was baseball, two words, in New York and the Great Lakes region, but it was called town ball in Philadelphia southwards, and it was called round ball in New England. And it was the rule.
We have to take a short break,
okay.
So we'll be back to talk a little more baseball and to take your calls in just a moment. My guest is Patricia O'Connor, English language expert. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking summer words with our English language expert, Patricia O'Connor. She is the proprietor of the blog GrammarPhobia.com. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100 with your favorite summer words, with your questions about the English language. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Or again, 866-780-9100. And let's finish up baseball. Pat, did you have anything else you wanted to mention?
Well, actually, yeah, I did. But first, I thought it was so interesting that you played the Beach Boys during that break because they have to be the quintessential summer rock group. I mean, you hear the Beach Boys and it's summertime no matter what time of year it is.
It's true. It transports you immediately.
Right. Yeah, good old Beach Boys. I love them. Actually, up in my attic, I have every one of their records, and they've probably cooked to a crisp by now, and they're all wavy. But baseball, the rules of the game were formalized in New York, and that's when the word baseball, which was being used in New York, became the dominant form of the word. You may find this hard to believe, but the term baseball has referred to other older games dating back at least as far as England in the 1740s. But it wasn't the game we know by that name. It was probably a game called Rounders. But you'll find the name baseball mentioned in Jane Austen, believe it or not. I once was on a show where I talked about Jane Austen coinages, and someone said, did you know that Jane Austen used the word baseball? And I thought, oh, couldn't be, but it's true.
In which book?
Well, I think it was Mansfield Park. Not positive, but it's true that it's in there, and it's true that it was used in England even earlier, 60 years before Jane Austen, but
it didn't refer to the same game.
To Rounders.
Okay.
Correct.
But, fascinating.
Yeah. And the game is defined, as we all know, played by two teams of nine players on a field marked by four bases in a diamond-shaped pattern. And it hasn't changed in, well, it's going on 200 years now, I guess. But, yeah, baseball is certainly the quintessential summer game.
Absolutely. All right, well, we have people who want to join in with their favorite summer words and their questions, and you can join in as well at 866-780-9100. I think this has to be one of your favorite topics ever, Pat.
Oh, good.
All right. Yeah, I don't think we've ever had such a long list before. Anne is on the line next in Muscatine. Hi, Anne.
Hello there.
Hi, what's your favorite summer word?
My favorite summer word is evanescent.
Oh, evanescent. Why do you associate it with summer? Bubbly drinks?
No, I associate it with that kind of glowing time just before dawn or just before the end of the day.
Oh, yeah.
On a beautiful summer day.
Yes, now that... Yes, evanescent, the adjective, it means gradually disappearing, fading away. And it was borrowed from Latin, evanescentum, which meant to disappear or vanish. Well, it's from a verb meaning to disappear or vanish. So it is a bit of a poignant word. Yeah, so you don't seem to notice the evanescence of the day as much in other seasons as you do in summer.
I enjoy it all year round. It's just a wonderful word, and I associated it with others that you chose to talk about today.
Oh, wonderful. Anne, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
And again, you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. And next, let's go to Suzanne in Grinnell. Hello, Suzanne.
Hi. Yeah, I just had a quick question. When I was a kid, we used to call flip-flops Zoris. And I didn't know whether that was just how regional or small to, you know, or time period. And I didn't know whether you'd ever heard of that.
What was the word now? Flory?
No, Zoris, as in Z. Zoris.
Oh, I don't know. But I do know that that flip-flops do have different names in different cultures.
Where did you grow up, Suzanne?
Berkeley, California.
Oh, now that's interesting. Huh.
A quick search shows me that there is at least a company called Zori that sells flip-flops. So I almost wonder if it's a brand name, but I don't know.
It might have been a brand name. I don't know. I just grew up calling them Zoris, but I've never heard anybody else say it. So.
They're okay. Called flip-flops, of course, because of the flopping noise they make when they pop up and hit your heel. You know, they slap you on the heel
yeah.
if you walk.
I think it's just a slang term. It doesn't. Somebody picked it up for a brand name. It looks like, but that is interesting, Suzanne. So, do you still call them Zoris?
I catch myself calling them Zoris, and I know nobody knows what it is. So then I just switch to, flip flops.
Well, thank you so much for your call, and that's certainly that sound of the flip-flop.
I know. Yep. You associate it with poolside. Everybody's slapping
Absolutely.
By.
Absolutely, and it drives me crazy when my kids wear them, but they move so slowly.
Oh.
All right, TJ is on the line next in Amana. Hi, TJ.
Good morning.
Hi.
My family, we grew up in Wyoming, and my father always used a couple of words. I think squatulate means to take off in the middle of the night. I don't know what its origins are. But a word that I've always been curious about and not been able to find much evidence of is the word Doniker. I think it means like a big stone sticking out of something. Are either of those familiar with you?
You? I think absquatulate is a comic term that's imitation Latin. I'm looking it up here right now. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to find it. Let me look.
I think it means take off in the middle of the night like you're running from maybe the bill collectors or something. Maybe depression time.
Well, let me see. That would be abscond.
if I can find
absquatulate here. I'm not finding absquatulate. But here it is. Absquatulate. Yes, you're right. Now, this was formed in the Midwest and the Western United States.
Okay.
And it means to depart in a hurry or abscond. Your horse has absquatulated.
That's exactly what my father would say.
Okay. But it is a mock Latin formation.
Perhaps how could we have let such a good word go?
Well, maybe it's not gone. It's right here in my, American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language, 5th edition. So it's alive. So, it hasn't gone. And if more
Well, I'm going to have to start working it into my everyday language.
Yeah, and what was the other word you mentioned? Doniker?
Doniker, like a big cement chunk or a rock chunk, but I haven't found that written, but he used it my whole life.
Do you know how it would have been spelled?
Well, I don't know. Doniker, maybe? I'm not sure.
Hmm.
I only ever heard it. I never saw it.
Yeah, let me see here. I'm not
finding... The only Donikers that I just found in a quick search refer to toilets, cesspools.
Maybe your father was putting you on.
he would just use it in conversation, and it was a word that my father was quite a wordsmith and did a lot of 50-cent words, but that was always, I could never find anything on it.
Interesting. Hmm. He sounds like a colorful guy.
Yeah.
He was.
We'll have to keep searching for that one.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm not finding it.
TJ, thank you so much for your call. Absquatulate. I do need to use that.
Yeah, it's a mock Latin formation.
All right, Tiff is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Tiff.
Hi.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
A word that I actually heard on NPR that has caught on to my job.
Okay.
The word is serial chiller.
Serial chiller.
Serial chiller.
C-H-I-L-L-E-R. Serial killer.
Oh, well, what is that? Somebody who goes around turning up the air conditioning?
No, somebody who's lazy.
Oh.
Who's on an interview on NPR. And they asked the guy, I think.
I love that. It's a wonderful insult.
Yeah. No, it's an admission.
Okay.
This guy who's on NPR, and I think he was a musician, and they asked him, what does he do when he's not touring? And he said he was a serial chiller.
Oh, he chills out.
Yeah. Right.
Yes, so he's a serial relaxer, more or less. Yeah.
He does nothing
Well, that's not so bad. That's not so bad.
No, it's not bad. It's not an insult at all.
Yeah,
it's
when you first said it, I thought you meant, somebody who's slacking on the job.
Right.
Well, it caught on at my job because I told it to people because I thought it was funny.
Uh-huh.
And so now we do use it as an insult at people who's slacking.
I was going to say, I looked it up in the Urban Dictionary, and they have an entry dating back to 2006, and it looks like they can use it both ways. A person who always kicks back or relaxes, one who rarely shoulders responsibility and avoids stress and anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's multiple meanings.
Yeah, that's how it caught on at my job. It means you're lazy. You're serial chiller.
Well, we like to serial chill in the summer, so that's a good summer term.
Yeah.
Well, and it's slightly nicer than some of the other things you could say about lazy coworkers. So.
Well, it's better than cussing at them.
Right.
Yeah.
Which we do also, but serial chiller is what we use now.
Nice. Well, Tiff, thank you so much for calling.
Good day.
All right. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're talking about summer words with our English language expert, Patricia O'Connor. And next up is Val in Des Moines. Hi, Val.
Hello.
Hi. What's your favorite?
One of my favorite summertime words is dappled sunlight.
Oh, yeah.
That's such an evocative phrase. That's beautiful.
Right. It evokes the image of light coming through the trees to leaves. Yeah.
Yes.
We also think of dappled gray horses.
Yes, kind of gray with little darker splotches all over them.
Right.
Kind of fancy horses.
Yes. Dappled is, it's been in the language since Middle English, and it's probably from the Old Norse word depil, which means spot or splash, which is a diminutive of dappi, pool, which brings us back to pool. But so in Old Norse, the word dappi, meaning pool, has been adapted in English to mean little pools of light or little pools of color.
Okay, that makes sense. So I have a question for you.
Uh-huh.
I'm writing a story, and one of my phrases in the story is sunlight dancing, dances dappling on spring green grass. Is that too much?
Well, you know, that's up to you. Say it again. Sunlight dancing on dappled spring green grass. Was that it?
Sunlight dances dappling on spring green grass.
I would remove the spring green. Maybe you could put that somewhere else.
Okay.
But because it sort of interrupts the image of the light.
Well, if it's dancing dappling, it has to be dancing on something, I think.
Oh, right, right,
or
on
I
the grass.
Thought, so
yeah.
Maybe just
But it's
dappling.
Up to you. This isn't a matter of correctness or anything like that. It's up to you what your ear tells you, and it probably depends on what's in the rest of the sentence. Or if the rest of your paragraph is pretty much straightforward with not much description, then you could throw in a whole lot in one of the sentences. So these things are it's a matter of taste.
Wonderful. Well, Val, thank you so much for your call. And a lot of people are solving the Zori question for us that Suzanne and Grinnell brought up.
Good.
And Anne in Des Moines is one of those people. Hi, Anne.
Hi.
Hi. So tell us about Zori.
Well, I grew up overseas, and I had friends who had spent time in Japan, and that was what they called the flip-flop. We were in Thailand, and of course there was a different name for them, but my understanding is it's a Japanese word.
Okay, so it comes from Japan, and there were, I suppose, with a large Japanese population in California, maybe that was Suzanne's connection to it?
Oh, I would suspect, yeah.
Interesting. Well, Anne, thank you for solving that puzzle for us.
All right. Thank you.
You know, Pat, I was thinking about, and I know that it's a misnomer, but, you know, people like to talk about all of the different words that Eskimos have for snow.
Mm-hmm.
But we just love to talk about summer, and we have so many different words for summer things and to describe sunshine and
uh-huh.
heat. And it far outweighs the number of months that we actually get to experience
oh, yeah.
summer.
Well, the same is true of spring, though. The caller who called in about the spring green grass. We use spring an awful lot, and yet it's not around any longer than summer.
Or even shorter.
Yeah. So these precious moments of spring and summer kind of stay with us all year round, and we keep describing things in those terms. In the same way that we listen to the Beach Boys in the dead of winter, you know, Surfer Girl or whatever.
Right. It transports us. A California
yeah.
Dreaming, that's not
oh,
the Beach
yeah.
Boys, I know, but
oh,
it's
yeah.
the same idea that it can take you somewhere else in the cold
uh-huh.
months of winter.
Yep.
Well, thank you for celebrating summer with us today, Pat.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
English language expert Patricia O'Connor, she is the author of Woe Is I and a number of other books about the English language. She's also the proprietor of the blog GrammarPhobia.com, and we'll have a little time to leave you with some more summer music today. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, we're going to celebrate Iowa in song.
Strawberries, cherries, and an angel's kiss in spring. My summer wine is really made from all these things.
I walked in town on silver spurs that jingled too. A song that I had only sang to just a few. She saw my silver spurs and said, let's pass some time, and I will give to you summer wine. Oh, summer wine.
Strawberries, cherries, and an angel's kiss in spring. My summer wine is...
Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.
Take off your silver spurs and help me pass the time, and I will give to you summer wine. Oh, summer wine.
My eyes grew heavy and my lips, they could not speak. I tried to get up.